Hello, it's Tuesday, May the 25th. I'm Andrew Pearce, and this is the Andrew Pearce Show, coming, as ever, from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up, dogs that can sniff COVID in a matter of seconds. We're talking about why falling borrowing is good news for the economy. You just spent lots of money on a gas boiler. I hope you haven't, because by 2035, they're all going to have to go and be replaced by very expensive alternative forms of energy making devices. Why are children playing less, particularly outdoors, since the pandemic? But first, I'm talking to Tom Tugendhat, who's the chairman of the Commons Foreign Affairs Select Committee, on the outrageous behaviour of Belarus in hijacking a Ryanair plane to arrest a dissident journalist. I'm joined now by Tom Tugendhat, who is the chairman of the Commons Foreign Affairs Select Committee. Tom Tugendhat, the Foreign Secretary said yesterday that he thinks the Russian government is almost certainly involved in this extraordinary hijacking of the Ryanair flight over Belarusian airspace. Do you agree with that?
Well, he certainly hinted at that. Now, I don't have any information that he may have access to. But there is certainly a suspicion that of the four people who seem to have been removed from the Ryanair flight, two were Belarus citizens. So that's obviously Roman Protasevich and his girlfriend. And two were Russian citizens, apparently. Their whereabouts is now somewhat more mysterious. And whether or not they were part of the operation to bring down the plane, or whether they were just Russian citizens who happened to have decided that Minsk was a nicer place than Vilnius, we simply don't know.
Already there's talk that we will obviously not allow any British flights to fly over Belarus airspace. We're going to bar the state airline from Belarus from flying into Britain. What more should be done? Should there be economic sanctions?
Well, I think we've got a very clear choice. You know, we've been dealing with a level of aggression coming out of Russia and its satellites, and Belarus is really just a Russian satellite. It's not an independent state in any real sense. We've been dealing with this level of violence now for many years. We've seen it in places like Estonia, where a border guard was kidnapped and a cyber attack launched. We've seen it in Ukraine, where an invasion has occupied Crimea and taken the eastern regions. We've seen it in Georgia, where South Ossetia and Abkhazia have been occupied. And we've seen it, of course, with the explosions in arms factories in Prague, the attempted murder of the Prime Minister of Montenegro, the attempted assassinations of the Skripals in Salisbury, and the use of chemical warfare, chemical weapons in reality, like polonium and Novichok in the UK. So we've seen a pattern of violence. And the choice for us is, do we want to stop it, or do we are we willing to tolerate a certain level of unrest? And I think we need to be very clear. If we want to stop it, then we need to expose those who are behind it. And we need to expose their money. We need to expose the level of corruption that sustains them. And we need to be willing to call them out in every possible forum. I think we can do that. And I look forward to seeing Putin's wealth, Lukashenko's wealth, advertised all over the front pages of every newspaper in the United Kingdom and around the world.
All British planes are now going to stop flying over Belarus to keep passengers safe. The worry is, isn't it, that if Belarus in any way seem to get away with this, Tom Tugendhat, other gangster states could do the same thing. I'm thinking Iran, maybe, possibly even Russia.
Well, you're absolutely right, and it's certainly true that other states will be looking at this and maybe drawing inspiration from it. And this shouldn't just worry, you know, people like me and you who may have said things that could offend some government, but actually it should worry everybody, because you may not think that you've done anything to offend a certain regime, but what about the person in the seat next to you or three rows ahead? You can't possibly know. And the reality is that if you don't know, there is a possibility that some regime on the ground will send up fighters to intercept your aircraft and force it to the ground. Now, other than being terrifying, that is actually incredibly dangerous. What happens if the pilot doesn't react quickly enough? What happens if the pilot doesn't go in the direction that the regime wants? You know, only a few years ago, in 2014, the Russian government shot down a civilian airliner over Ukraine, killing hundreds of people. This is not an idle threat. This is a very real danger.
And what of this journalist? We saw him. He'd clearly been pressurised into giving that confession on television. There were bruises on his face. He told people on the plane he feared he could be subjected to the death penalty. Do you think we're going to see? Are we going to see him again?
Well, I very much hope so. And we should make it absolutely clear to Alexander Lukashenko that he is personally responsible for the safety of Roman Protasevich. It is he who ordered the MiG fighters to intercept the Ryanair jet. It's he who ordered the arrest of Mr. Protasevich, and it's he who is now responsible for him in detention and for his release because he's being held illegally and without any real legitimate charge. So I think we need to be very clear that it is Mr. Lukashenko and Mr. Lukashenko alone who is personally responsible for the safety of Roman Protasevich.
He is the Europe's last dictator, isn't he?
Well, he's one of two. There's also President Putin in Russia.
Yes, I suppose there is. Yes, yes. That is Tom Tugendhat, who is the chairman of the Commons Foreign Affairs Select Committee. Thanks for joining us. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and video series. The coronavirus lockdowns have had devastating effects on the way British children play, with half playing outdoors with friends less and a third saying they play alone a lot more. The research by Save the Children Fund found that 9 in 10 children said the lockdown had changed the way they played. I'm joined now by Dan Paskins, who's Director of UK Impact at Save the Children. This is a cause of concern, isn't it? That children, a lot of them, are playing outside less and with friends less.
It certainly is a concern, and it's something which after the last year and all the different restrictions and everything sort of children have had to go through is a great concern, and you know, it does run the risk of affecting them for the long term. The good news, though, is there is a real opportunity now as lockdown restrictions do start to ease, and particularly we think in the run to the summer holidays, to really get everyone together and make this something that we can really do something about, and you know, encourage children, enable children to be able to play, to be able to get back into the old routines and spend more time with friends and family.
And of course, because of lockdown, a lot of kids would have been kept indoors. A lot of children won't, of course, have gone to school. So they've been denied that exercise. How important is it in a child's development, in your view, that they are outside as much as possible and playing outside as much as possible with other children?
It's absolutely vital, and it's something where we all know that children enjoy playing, they enjoy spending time with other children, but there's also a lot of research which shows that actually play is really important for children's mental and physical well-being, for their development, their ability to form relationships. So if they're playing outdoors less, if they're sort of sitting inside on their own more, it does have the potential to damage their long-term development.
And we know there's talk, isn't there, that the government are going to be spending money on summer schools this year. How important is that, do you think, Dan?
So it's clearly very important that after all the disruption of of the last year, children not being able to spend time at school, particularly some children not being able to be able to do any of the sort of online learning, all the sort of children who didn't have sort of laptops or access to that. It's clearly important that there's investment by the government in helping those children sort of catch up on their learning. That said, we've been listening to lots of children and families, and what's going to be really important is making sure that we sort of start with things that help to improve children's mental and physical well-being, and that actually set them up to be able to sort of learn for the long term. So we're a little bit concerned if the only thing that happens is just longer school days or more time in the classroom. And we also know that some of the language isn't really helping. This idea that children have sort of fallen behind and all this quite negative language puts extra sort of stress and pressure on children, on families. So we think alongside, the catch-up support, which is really welcome, that support from the government, but not just from the government, businesses, charities can all play their bit, doing everything we can to make sure children can learn by playing, can, spend time with their friends. It sounds like, something which is, a nice to do, but we also think it's a vital part of the sort of long-term strategy for children's recovery.
And just finally, Dan, of course, a lot of children live in homes where there's no garden, there's no outside space. So it puts them at a disadvantage in the first place. And of course, many of those children will be from poorer, disadvantaged backgrounds.
That's certainly right. And we've been, I'd say, the children doing a lot to support families over the last year, providing really sort of practical help, you know, trying to, as well as trying to sort of make the case for the sort of changes that are needed. And that's why we're joining together with a lot of other organisations, you know, including people like Arsenal and Lego, to call for a sort of summer of play campaign. And we're really encouraging businesses, charities and government, everyone, to pledge their support to make this a summer which during which children can play and have opportunity to play, particularly as well thinking about, you know, what can we all do to make sure, you know, those children who have had the toughest time of last year, who don't have space for a garden, who have fewer opportunities, what can we all do to create more opportunities for them?
Absolutely. That's Dan Paskins. He's Director of UK Impact at Save the Children. So visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all our podcasts, our videos, our opinion pieces and more. If you want to get in touch, you can tweet us at MailPlus or me at Tory Boy Pierce. Gas boilers are going to be banned within 14 years under the government plans to tackle climate change. Ministers are discussing a cut-off date of 2035, after which the installation of conventional gas boilers will be outlawed. One Tory former minister, Steve Baker, has warned the move could spark a consumer backlash. Environmentalists, though, say it's not enough. I'm joined now by Georgina Wilson-Powell, author of Is It Really Green? And the publisher of Pebble Magazine. I've got to tell you, Georgina, I've just bought a new boiler. It cost me about £5,000 or £6,000 a year ago. I'd be really furious if I thought I was going to have it ripped out in 3 or 4 years' time.
I don't think you're going to have to rip it out in 3 or 4 years' time. But obviously the details haven't all yet been announced. But at some point we are all going to have to move over to less carbon heavy forms of heating our homes. But really also boilers are only part of the issue here. There's a much bigger sort of conversation about how we can reduce the emissions that our homes cause from lots of different routes.
But what's the problem with a boiler? Do explain.
So a lot of the UK's boilers run on gas. Gas is very carbon carbon heavy. We're looking to move away to a net zero. The government's got the net zero target in at 2050. And actually about 85% of the UK is using gas boilers. And the energy use from all of our homes, so there's about between 27 million homes in the UK, actually contributes 14% to the UK's greenhouse gas emissions. So the government seems to have worked out that they can't get to net zero by 2050 by working, you know, without changing the kind of ways that we heat our homes.
How are we going to heat our homes then from 2035? What are we going to do? We're going to have to pull out all our radiators.
There are already lots of different opportunities and sort of options, so ranging from moving over to renewable electricity to installing air source heat pumps. But what I think what hasn't seemed to have happened is there hasn't been a decent enough conversation about how we heat our homes without gas, what the alternatives are, and actually giving people a chance to be involved in that conversation. This seems to just have been landed in our laps a little bit, and I think that could be done a lot better.
Explain, how would I heat my home by using renewable energy? Have I got to have a wind turbine on my roof or something?
No, you could. So we actually took out our gas boiler a couple of years ago. I live in a flat. It's a 1960s building, and we heat our home from renewable electricity. You can also use an air source heat pump, which actually heats up the air taken from outside and pushes it through. I know they're looking at hydrogen forms of boilers as well, which will replace the gas with hydrogen, which is slightly less carbon intensive. And then there's obviously things like solar and things like that. But it does totally depend on what kind of building you live in, what part of the UK you live in, whether you own, whether you rent. I think there's a lot more questions to come out of this than really the information that we've been given so far.
I was going to say, if you rent your flat, for instance, and in 2035, and the landlord says, go to hell, I'm not doing it, how does it become enforceable?
That is a very good question. Who knows? We're waiting for a lot more details to come through. There's obviously got to be considerations for people that are renting. There's got to be considerations for social housing, for low-income families. You know, there's a lot to be considered here. This would be a massive move.
And is renewable energy and these alternative forms of heating, Georgina, are they more expensive than what we're paying for at the moment? Because that would be a problem for a lot of people if they are more expensive.
I think there's going to be an issue around installation and the cost of installation, and also the infrastructure isn't particularly there already. We've relied on gas for so long, and we've not had to think about anything else that for me, there definitely is an issue around infrastructure and capacity. But I'm hoping, you know, over sort of the next decade and a half, we can sort of look to build on that. And obviously, as more people move over to alternatives from gas, the kind of cost does come down. But I totally agree that the cost right now is prohibitive for most people.
You say the cost could be prohibitive. What would it cost, for instance, if I'm to replace my gas boiler with a form of renewable energy? What would the installation cost be, and what would the monthly outlay be? On average?
I mean, it's difficult to say, isn't it? It depends on the size of your house and what you use your energy and your heating for, and it also depends how well insulated your home is. So for me, there's obviously the installation cost, which I believe for an air source heat pump is around 10,000. But for me as well, the ongoing running cost can be brought down so much by actually taking the opportunity to properly insulate your home. And that is something that everybody can do bit by bit, no matter what size of home you've got or how old your home is. And for me, that's the missing part of the conversation, because we've sort of fixated on boilers, but actually making sure your home is insulated properly will bring down your cost no matter what energy you're using.
But that £10,000, that's hugely expensive, and that's going to be way beyond most families' budgets, I would have thought.
Absolutely, and there needs to be incentives for this to happen. I mean, you know, for me it's a bit similar to, electric cars coming in, which again is something we all need to be doing, but they're coming in 2030, and we also need to have a conversation about the infrastructure we're going to need for those, and ultimately everyone's going to have to swap over to an electric car. There is a similarity there. You know, a part of the problem is obviously the installation cost for individuals, but we also as a country need better infrastructure to help people move over, and to make sure once they do move over that we have capacity. There's an awful lot of planning that needs to go in before we start, you know, putting deadlines in places for people to move over. So hopefully this will be the start of a much bigger conversation, and we can start to sort of, you know, explain why everyone needs to move over in lots of different things in the next decade.
Right, that's Georgina Wilson-Power. She's author of Is It Really Green? And she's the publisher of Pebble Magazine. Thanks for joining us. Well, it's now time for our regular city update with, of course, Ruth Sunderland, who's business editor at the Daily Mail. Ruth, government borrowing falling in April. What does that mean? What should we read into that?
Well, yes, it's very interesting, Andrew. So borrowing obviously still is very high. So it's come in. So borrowing, obviously, this is the difference between the money that government's spending and the money that it's bringing in from tax revenues. And in April, it came to £31.7 billion. Now, that's a lot of money. It's the second highest April figure since records started, but it's 15.6 billion lower than it was in April of last year, and it's significantly better than people feared. So looking at the financial year overall, so that's the year to March, the government borrowed about £300 billion in total, and that is lower than what was previously estimated, significantly down. And also, the expectation looking ahead is that we'll borrow less than people initially thought we would have to do. And the upshot, which is excellent news, provided it actually happens, is that all the concern that the Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, would have to put up taxes or cut back on government spending, well, economists now think that there's much less chance that he'll need to do that. So it's a far better outcome than had been envisaged. Of course, all this does depend on us not lurching back into another lockdown and there not being a rampant new variant or something like that. And I think it shows how high the stakes are. You know, if we can maintain the momentum in the economy that we got from our lead on the vaccine, then, you know, we can bounce back really strongly, Andrew.
Yeah, so it could be a turbocharged recovery next year, Ruth. And then, of course, the fixed-term Parliament Act will have gone. The Prime Minister can then call an early general election the following year.
Absolutely. So I think he will be looking to capitalise on a bounce. There's lots of money there waiting to be spent. There's lots of pent-up demand. And provided that we're not derailed, then I think we could find that the UK economy outperforms a lot of our international rivals. You know, that's what the IMF, for example, is expecting. Now, I don't want to underestimate the impact of borrowing, because we're still looking at borrowing at a rate that, you know, we haven't seen in peacetime, really. I mean, this is sort of levels as a percentage of GDP that you would have had following the Second World War. So we do need, again, you know, we all need to get back to work. We need to get everybody off furlough. We need to get the economy firing on all cylinders. And I would say, just as we all help the NHS, you know, we all need now to start trying to help the economy and making sure that we've got a prosperous future.
It's an excuse for me and you to go shopping, Ruth.
Do you know what? I never need an excuse, Andrew.
That's Ruth Sunderland, who's business editor at the Daily Mail. Thanks for joining us. So, they're faster than PCR and more accurate than lateral flow tests. The latest weapons against COVID have four legs and a wet nose. A study published this week found that people who are infected with coronavirus give off a distinct odour, and highly trained dogs can detect it with pinpoint precision. They are, of course, the medical detection dogs, and their founder and chief executive, Dr. Claire Guest, joins me now. Claire, you and I have talked about these remarkable dogs for years because they've been so instrumental in the fight against detecting cancer. Now you can use them in coronavirus, and we know that this virus could be with us for years, so the dogs could be very important.
Absolutely. I mean, the results are remarkable, and this is the first time we've ever worked training dogs to detect a virus. So, you know, although we had, you know, huge enthusiasm and we believed that this could work, we really didn't believe that the dogs would be able to do it so accurately, so more accurately actually than a lateral flow test. So it's the same science as we've talked about before. So, you know, when we have an illness, a disease, this changes our body odour. And dogs, with their incredible sense of smell, can be trained to detect it. And, you know, as you mentioned, we've done work in cancer. We're still working in cancer and working with, collaborating with MIT in the USA to try and translate this into an electronic device. But, you know, for diseases like COVID-19, we need dogs working now and helping us with this terrible fight against the pandemic.
These dogs, I mean, you formed medical detection dogs, I think, 2008. They can detect odour changes in people with type 1 diabetes, other severe disorders. These dogs, presumably, Claire, could be at airports, for instance, to check when people coming into this country, whether they've got the virus.
Absolutely. So what we're looking at is a really rapid test. So what we're talking about, rapid screen and then follow up those individuals that the dogs alert on with a PCR test. So we're not, you know, replacing the PCR test, but what we're doing is, if you can imagine, quite rightly say, you know, 300 people getting off an aircraft, you need to very quickly identify whether any of them need a PCR. Now, what the dogs can do, they can sniff each second as they move past in the queue. It takes about a second per person, and the dog then will indicate those individuals that smell of COVID and need to have a PCR test. Now, this will make, I mean, all we see is these huge queues at the airports, you know, and this huge difficulty, because any test that is a non-dog test takes a lot of time. And these things take a long time to process. So the dogs could really help getting us back to normal.
And I think the tests which you did with the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine showed, didn't they, Claire, that the dogs had a success rate of 94.3%, which is a lot better than a lateral flow test, which is under 60%.
Absolutely. So the problem with lateral flow tests is that their accuracy drops off rapidly when they start, if somebody is asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic or has a low viral load. Now, what the dogs indicated was that they remain as reliable with low viral loads. This means that they can pick out people who perhaps at that moment in time are not showing symptoms, but will go on, you know, either to get symptoms or be asymptomatic carriers in the next few hours or days. So this, again, is really important that the dogs have shown this ability. And again, it's something that could really, really help in our fight, particularly against, say, new variants. I mean, there was the dogs were trained on what I call the original variant, but they were tested in the test sets, and there were some of the new Kent variant, which the dogs identify very, very accurately as well. So what we're looking at is a sort of rapid screen that could quickly tell you if somebody coming off a plane has got COVID, and perhaps even a new variant that's going to be much more transmissible.
Sounds fantastic. Now, people will be curious about the dogs, Claire. Am I correct in saying gun dog breeds, spaniels, retrievers, labradors make particularly good detection dogs?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're dogs, aren't they, that love using their nose. You know, the sort of dog that if you throw the tennis ball into the long grass, you know, 100 times, they want you to throw it 100 times more. They've got these fantastic, you know, sort of olfactory equipment on the, you know, with 350 million sensory receptors. So, you know, these dogs are just born to work. And in fact, as you'll remember, Andrew, some of the dogs we use are rescue dogs. And two of the dogs actually in this phase one study were from rescue centres. So it's a real win-win for both man and dog.
Yeah, and I think, Claire, it takes up to, what, about 10 weeks to train them in detection?
Yeah, it's the actual collection of samples, the odour samples, which takes more time, funnily enough, because you have to collect those from, you know, from patients and people. So, but yeah, 10 weeks and the dogs will learn the odour and be able to identify it very reliably.
Well, fantastic news, and let's hope the NHS take up the dogs. That's Claire Guest from the Medical Detection Dogs charity. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app every weekday at 5 p.m. You can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.